Okay, a year ago, Citigroup's Peter Atherton admitted that the European Union's emissions trading system had, and I'll quote, done nothing to curb emissions and acted as a highly regressive tax falling mostly on poor people. On whether the policy goals of reducing emissions were achieved, he said, prices up, emissions up, profits up. Who wins, who loses? And he says, all generation-based utilities, winners. Coal and nuclear-based generators, biggest winners. Hedge funds and energy traders, even bigger winners. Losers, consumers. Now, this example is just one of so many that highlights how capitalist solutions, or so-called solutions to environmental catastrophe, are not only no solution, but in fact often make things worse. Today, we have a stark choice. We can have either capitalism or a habitable planet. One or the other, not both. Marxists argue that the only solution to a system that is unsustainable by its very nature to indeed have a habitable planet is major social change, a complete transformation of the society we live in, to it into a system of socialism. Now, why do we pin the blame for environmental disaster on capitalism? Why not human greed, overpopulation, or just industrialisation? How can we have any basis for thinking that even socialism could usher in a sustainable world? After all, while capitalism is destructive, so have been many pre-capitalist societies, which have caused ecological collapse around them and even their own disintegration. And why can't reforms deliver a sustainable world? Renewable energy is well within our reach, and innovative solutions are the hallmark of human societies, capitalism more so than any other. Now, while there's no denying that capitalism is innovative and its immense productivity has made it possible for the first time in human history to feed, clothe, and house everyone, the succession of capitalism was more like jumping out of the frying pan into the fire than any sustainable resolution of earlier society's environmental problems. And none have described why this is so better than Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, nor the how and why of bringing about fundamental change necessary for the world's survival. Capitalism, Marx and Engels explain, is a class society with two main opposing classes. On the one hand, there's the factory owner, the banker, the employers or ruling class, who own and control what Marx called the means of production, that is, you know, the factories and the goods to produce society's goods, and the state forces that back up this class in power. And on the other, the working class, who have only their labour power, that is, their ability to make society's goods. They only have this labour power to sell and their own self-organisation to resist capitalist rule. It is where these classes meet, in the workplaces of the world, where society's goods and resulting wealth are produced, that defines the special nature of capitalism. Here, capital combines the mass labour power of workers associated with the necessary machinery, you know, the computers, the trucks, the tractors and so on, with the world's natural resources to produce commodities or goods. The goods that are produced, however, do not belong to the workers who made them, either for their own use or even to trade for other useful items. Now, at work, you know, just see what happens when you try to take home something that you just made. Then you'll suddenly realise how much you don't own that particular item. Nor do workers have any say in what is produced. Instead, the goods are the property of the employer, who then proceeds to sell these items for more than it costs to produce them. In other words, at a profit. It's the profitability that determines what goods are made. So you'll make bombs rather than medicines and that kind of thing. And it is only in this process of exchange, when you sell the goods, the realisation of the profit, that capitalism recognises what for it is valuable. And keep this in mind, because this is the thing that they value more than anything else. This means that the underlying dynamic of capitalism, what really drives the system, is not how the goods produced satisfy human needs for a living, though, of course, they have to a certain extent, because otherwise you wouldn't have any workers to do the job. Nor is it about what is sustainable or safe for the world and its inhabitants. The driver of the system is production for the profit that can be made. And because the system runs on making profit, and in fact a necessarily increasing profit, as I'll explain, this sets up a highly competitive world system as companies battle it out for market share, for profit share. And as a consequence, a highly innovative economy as firms are pushed to continually seek profits from new markets, new goods, or cheaper ways of manufacturing existing goods. And this relentless search for profit leads to a greater intensification of production, to the greater automation and mechanisation, which actually strikes at the heart, very heart, of capitalist profitability. As the import of workers' labour power, the only source of the added value to the production process that is the source of profit, as the import of workers' labour power is decreased by using more machinery, the amount of profit per item or the rate of profit is also lower. Now, the actual dollars, of course, that any one company may make can rise, and we've seen the record profits of billions of dollars from resource companies such as ExxonMobil or BHP Billiton, but the overall trend in the system is and has to be for the rate of profit to decline as the human labour input is reduced in each process, which, of course, can only push the system on and on, sucking in more and more raw materials, forcing massive expansion of production as it must pull in more profit to counter this downward trend. And I'll just give you one small example. With the demand for biofuels, it's more profitable to sell corn for fuel than food, and that leads to rising prices and more hunger, but also more fields turned over to corn rather than other necessities. Another biofuel source is palm oil, and here you see tropical forests, which provide little or no profit to capital, cleared at ever-increasing rates to plant monocultures of palm trees. And the absurdity is that clearing the forests removes the carbon sinks and increases greenhouse gas emissions, the very problems that the biofuels are meant to counter. Now, moreover, because profit is collected not as more products, but what's known as a universal equivalent or money, it has another property critical to capitalism's destructive potential. Unlike natural resources, which can run out and can't be sort of accumulated, you can't just keep on having more and more of them, money profit is quantitatively unlimited, and it can continue to be produced and accumulated for so long as there is anything, and I mean anything, left to process and workers left to run the machines. What this means is that there is no natural containment of capitalist operations short of human extinction. As the Polish revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg described a century ago, capital impelled to appropriate productive forces for the purposes of exploitation ransacks the whole world. It procures its means of production from all corners of the earth, seizing them if necessary by force from all levels of civilization and from all forms of society. So what we see is an unstoppable, accelerating treadmill of production, where, as Karl Marx writes, the division of labour is necessarily followed by a greater division of labour, the application of machinery by still greater application of machinery, works on a large scale by works on a still larger scale. This is the law driven by competition, which again and again throws bourgeois production out of its old course and which compels capital to intensify the productive forces of labour. And because it has intensified them, this law gives capital no rest, continually whispering in its ear, go on, go on. Now, a lot of what Marx and Engels wrote about concerned the way that capitalism worked, the class system and its exploitation and degradation of the mass of humanity and the world around it. But their project was a completely new society, what they called communism. So they wanted to understand how the old gave birth to the new. What were the forces that could transform societies? Alongside their understanding of the class dynamics of capitalism, their earlier studies of revolutions and upheavals that saw the overthrow of feudalism and their involvement in the social movements, working class organisations and revolts of the 1800s, Marx and Engels made their case for the one class, the working class, that could be what they called the grave diggers of capitalism and the creators of socialism. Yet, if they were to argue for a new society brought into being by workers, not only was it important to understand how the relations between people would be revolutionised, but also humanity's relationship with its surrounding environment. As Nikolai Bukharin was to say some years later, human society is unthinkable without its environment. So the dilemma facing Marx and Engels was that if humanity's survival was only possible at the expense of nature, as it seemed under capitalism, or if every sort of society wrecked the planet, then would socialism be no better than capitalism? Now, the 1800s provided plenty of material to explore humanity's changing interaction with the planet, to understand what made capitalism so destructive and how socialism could be sustainable. In fact, in the mid-1800s, the environment was as live an issue as it is today. Pollution, soil degradation, the appalling conditions of life for the growing working class in the towns, especially the frenetic search for new land and resource supplies, these were the hot topics of political discussion and scientific research. And Marx and Engels closely followed what was going on in the debates and struggles over these key environmental issues. And what's not so commonly known is that their studies on the question of the soil and land use led them to one of their key insights. By the mid-1840s, Europe and US potentially faced starvation as crop production faltered because intensive capitalist farming had drained the soil of nutrients. The search for nitrogen, which is one of the missing nutrients, both as a soil additive and to manufacture the newly discovered explosive TNT, triggered imperialist competition for prized sources in South America, leading to the inevitable wars and impoverishment of the mass of the region's peoples. It was called the War of the Americas, much as the Iraq-Afghanistan wars do today in competition for that other prized resource, oil. Now, just to give you an idea of the intensity of this scramble for nitrogen, a British officer reported witnessing the simultaneous loading of guano, which is the original source of the nitrogen, on 100 ships from a single island off the coast of Peru. There were 44 US ships, 40 English, 5 French, 2 Dutch, 1 Italian, 1 Belgian, 1 Norwegian, 1 Swedish, 1 Russian, 1 Armenian, and 3 Peruvian. Now, of course, before you scoured the globe for fertiliser, you had to know enough of soil science to know what essential nutrients were missing. One of the most important scientists researching capitalist agriculture and the problem of soil degradation, and one who had a huge influence on Marx and Engels, was a bloke called Justus von Liebig. For Liebig, a system of production that took more from nature than it put back was a robbery system, which is exactly how he described industrialised capitalist agriculture. And this robbery didn't just occur within one country. Great Britain, he wrote, robs all countries of the conditions of their fertility, as the disastrous state of Ireland's agriculture showed. And Liebig linked these ideas of soil impoverishment, of the necessity of nutrient recycling, to the newly understood biological processes of metabolism. Now, while the term initially referred just to the processes of exchange between at the level of individual cells or organisms, Marx took this concept up and extended it to humanity as a whole, and to describe the complex dynamic interchange between human beings and nature. In fact, Marx emphasised, man lives from nature. Nature is his body, and he must maintain a continuing dialogue with it if he is not to die, for man is a part of nature. But he pointed out that our continuing dialogue or metabolism with nature differs in important ways to that of other organisms. A couple of researchers, Brett Clark and Richard York, in their study of the world's carbon cycle, comment on Marx's insight, and they say labour is the process in which humans interact with nature through the exchange of organic matter. In this metabolic relationship, this exchange, humans both confront the nature-imposed conditions of the processes found in the material world and affect these processes through labour and the associated structure of production. It's this labour, this interchange, that gives humanity the ability to uncouple production from nature's limits, albeit only temporarily, as is all too clear today. An uncoupling or rupture described by Marx as a metabolic rift, and he refers to this a lot in his writings. But only capitalism, Marx realised, which makes this rift or uncoupling a reality, because, as he said, it prevents the return to the soil of its constituent elements consumed by man in the form of food and clothing. Hence, it hinders the operation of the eternal natural conditions for the lasting fertility and sustainability of the soil. And, of course, if we have no sustainable, if we have no soil, we have no plants, we have no life. Let's examine this more closely. Jason Moore, who's written extensively on the transition from feudalism to capitalism, explains Marx and Engels saw that with the transition to capitalism, a new division of labour between town and country, an antagonistic and inherently unstable division of labour, took shape, whereby the products of the countryside flowed into the cities, which were under no obligation to return the waste products to the point of production. Nutrients were pumped out of one ecosystem and transferred to another. The so-called waste, instead of, as they said, being recycled at the source of agricultural production to reinvigorate the land, was simply dumped as poisoning and polluting waste around the towns, in the rivers and oceans, with huge impacts on workers' health. So what we have then is a capitalist form of production that not only undercuts its own profit-making system, the thing that drives it, by the falling rate of profit that I talked about before, but as Marx points out, can only develop production by simultaneously undermining the original sources of all wealth, the soil and the worker. By trashing people's lives in the cities, by trashing the countryside, they destroyed both. Now, in any rational world, this would bring some questioning of the direction society was moving in. But as Marx and Engels' analysis shows, this degradation, this pulling away of all these nutrients and everything, just intensifies the exploitation as more things are sought for. And Jason Moore writes, "Fresh land is worthless without fresh labour. Consequently, each expansion of the world economy has been accompanied not only by an expansion of the system's potential natural resource base, but also equally by a new phase of accumulation in previously unexploited areas, what's called primitive accumulation, which is not only an economic and ecological process, but also equally a moment of intense class struggle." And this is worth keeping in mind. And you only have to look at the history of Britain during the 19th century or China today to see examples of this. Now, Moore goes on, "These fresh supplies of land and labour in turn are worthless without a reconstruction and expansion of the system's built environment, especially its transportation networks, its control of water and genetic stock, and its urban forms and agrarian settlement patterns. In sum, a reorganisation and geographical expansion of this town-country division of labour, the thing that that brings about the metabolic rift." So it deepens it even further. So that, as Moore says, delivers round after round of capitalist expansion through a two-part process that cuts the costs of resources and labour, temporarily overcoming some of the problems of the falling rate of profit and some of the problems of supply. And Moore says, firstly, this reorganisation increases demand for production. So it increases demand for fertilisers, for tractors, for genetically engineered crop varieties and so on. And that permits raising the output of primary products in a more cost-effective way than previously possible, thereby cutting the cost for industrial and commercial capital and allowing for a new phase of material expansion. So you're getting the idea here that capitalism is just on this treadmill. Secondly, through the process of primitive accumulation, each reorganisation leads to the widespread deruralization and creation of a massive reserve army of labor, again China comes to mind, that ultimately lowers costs and provides capitalists with new opportunities for reorganization of industry. The newly and greatly enlarged reserve army is in turn fed more cheaply, cutting capitalism's wage bill even further by the new organization of agriculture on a world scale. The process then begins again, each time generating social and ecological contradictions that are increasingly powerful and disruptive, and, as I said, ever deepening Marx's metabolic rift. Now we come to the last part of Marx's analysis, Marx and Engels' analysis of capitalism and the environment, though not the last word that I'm going to quote from them. While today there are only a few people who argue that climate change is a furphy, now George Bush and his mates are among them, and some of the Australian right-wing think tank members like a bloke called John Roskam, whom we're blessed with down here. Nonetheless, most people from out-and-out capitalists to many in the environment movement look to reforms of capitalism to resolve the crisis we face. In particular, one group of theorists known as ecological modernists argue that through the ongoing modernisation and rationalisation of industry, society will progress to a green state where environmental regulation and environmentally benign industries will produce a sustainable future while market economies, that is capitalism, can continue to develop. But Marx pointed to a fatal flaw in this line of thought, and he wrote, as the scale of production grows and the productive power of labour grows through this cooperation, through the division of labour, through the machinery and so on, so does the mass of raw material and ancillaries such as energy that go into the daily reproduction process. And that sort of mass and energy throughput is called a matter-energy throughput, which I'll refer to later, but that's the technical term for it today. In other words, although technological development may make some processes more energy efficient or use up less materials, the intensification of production Marx refers to actually means society uses more raw materials and energy overall. The matter-energy throughput is greater. And the coal industry of the 1860s proved Marx's point. Puzzled by the increased coal usage despite improved processing, British economist William Stanley Jevons found that precisely because it was more efficient, more production was possible, so coal was more in demand. In what became known as the Jevons paradox, he showed that greater efficiency in resource use leads to increased consumption of resources, just as Marx had described. But it's not as though the capitalists of Jevons' time had any choice in this. It's not as though they made some rational decision to increase production, thereby increasing coal-fired energy use. They're driven by the need to make profit, ever-increasing profit, as I've said. They had to expand production, just as their competitors were, powered on by cheaper inputs. And the same applies today more than ever to the carbon cycle, which results in the carbon dioxide emissions that everyone's so rightly concerned about. Clark and York found that between 1975 and 1996, carbon efficiency improved dramatically in the US, the Netherlands, Japan, and Austria. However, over this same period, total carbon dioxide emissions and per capita emissions increased in all four countries. In other words, an example of the Jevons paradox. So, to pull all this together, we have, as Marx and Engels showed, a society that is based on production for profit, not human need or environmental sustainability. The drive for profit forces capital to constantly intensify production, new machines, new raw materials, greater energy needs, and part of this has the apparently contradictory effect of pushing down the rate of profit, thus driving capitalism on to ever greater feats of production, forever whispering as it in its ear, as Marx so graphically put it, go on, go on. However, humanity is not simply suspended above nature. It is, as Marx says, part of nature. And without a continuing dialogue or metabolism with nature, we will die. Capitalism, unlike any earlier society, has brought about a rupture or rift, uncoupling in humanity's dialogue with nature, what Marx calls the metabolic rift. And as he shows, there's no ending of this rift within capitalism, because every technological fix for its crises, every step to increase profits, simply means a reorganisation and geographical extension of this town-country division of labour, an intensification of the matter-energy throughput, and that is, you know, a deepening of the rift. Our conclusion then must be that capitalism by its very nature cannot support a sustainable future for the world. More, it can drive us further and faster to a dead planet than any other form of production. As Paul Burkett comments, we may not like it, but the fact is that capitalism can survive any ecological catastrophe short of the extinction of human life. Now, arming ourselves with this theoretical understanding of the way that capitalism works, the way it interacts with the environment, is the first step in avoiding the final catastrophe. However, as Marx himself so famously put it, the philosophers have only interpreted the world. The point is to change it. And it's here that Marx and Engels have again led the way. I've emphasised so far the destructive potential of capitalism for the planet and everyone on it, but capitalism also sows the seeds of its own destruction from what you might call its successes, and in doing so has laid the basis for a new society, a way to change the world. Socialism is not possible in a society racked by scarcity. Capitalism has extended the development of human productive forces to end that scarcity to the extent that, as Engels puts it, alone makes possible a state of society in which there are no longer class divisions or anxiety over the means of subsistence for the individual, and in which, for the first time, there can be talk of real human freedom, of an existence in harmony with the laws of nature. That is socialism. Socialism, unlike capitalism, could make this happen because in place of the competitive pursuit of private profit, it would make human needs and capabilities and the survival of the planet where we live is very much a human need. Socialism would make human need the main priority of production, distribution and consumption. This prioritisation of use values, that is what's needed, over the exchange value or the profit making, is what creates the potential for Marx and Engels communism to reduce society's reliance on growing productive but ecologically damaging throughput of matter and energy. But Engels was quick to emphasise that we can't get sustainable socialism simply by reforming capitalism, by somehow making its production processes greener, by passing bills that stop capitalists making profits, for the reasons I've gone through. He argued instead we have to have a complete revolution of the society we live in and the way that we produce things. And how can this revolutionary change happen? And here we turn to what I've called capitalism's successes, the creation of a new class, the working class. Because it's the class that actually produces society's wealth, it has within its power the potential to transform society, to become capitalism's grave diggers. Now, Marx and Engels often talked about workers as being ground down by the system in which they lived, but that wasn't the only way that they saw this working class. He pointed that along with the oppression grows the revolt of the working class, a class always increasing in numbers and disciplined, united, organised by the very mechanism of production of the capitalist process. And as it grows, it becomes more concentrated in greater masses, its strength grows, and it feels that strength the more. Replaces the isolation of the labourers due to competition by their revolutionary combinations due to association. And to take these combinations further, to build their confidence, their self-organisation, their unity as a class, as Marx says, preparing for the overthrow of the entire old society and the building of the new, workers' organisations today have to be in the thick of struggle for every reform, every opportunity to challenge the existing rulers. In other words, as Marx described, acting as the organising centres of the working class, aiding every social and political movement. How am I going for time?
30 minutes.
Okay. Over the weekend and in today's discussion, there'll be lots of chances to go over many examples of what I've been talking about, and there are more in the pamphlet that we talked about before, how capitalism is costing us the earth. I'm just going to point to one recent example in America. There's a thing called the Just Transition Alliance, and it was set up by Black and Latino groups in the US working with unions to negotiate alliances between what they called the frontline workers and the fence line communities. That is, between union members who work in polluting industries and stand to lose their jobs if the plant is shut down, and those who live next to the same plant and stand to lose their health if it's not. In Rialto, I think that's the way you explain it, in Arizona, 107 African-American, Latino and Anglo workers at Arizona Portland Cement work closely with the local community. They've had community cleanups, they've had joint picketing outside the plant and rallies at the community, at the corporate headquarters, and they won a new union deal, which they said was sort of, because of the support from the community, was one of the reasons that they won this. So whether it's the alliances that we build in the small towns, the hundreds of thousands on the streets, or the mass industrial action, we can start to shift the corporations. But to really take on the might of the capitalist system, we need to go further. Out of the struggle must come the revolutionary organisations of workers that we build in the here and now to be the force that can overthrow the capitalist system and become the class that is ready to build a new socialist society. And I'll just finish with one small quote from a paraphrase from Joel Cavell, who wrote a book called The Enemy of Nature. And he says, "All creatures must end, and all species. Even the earth and time and space will vanish. We, however, have some choice over our end. We should not allow the exit to occur under the cold, cruel hand of capital. For what other class has been given the chance to transform the relation between humanity and nature?" Comrades, what a fantastic challenge.